Everyone can hear me all right? Okay. My name is Kyra Cabanas, and I'll be doing the Brown Bag Lunch Lecture today. So if at any time you can't hear me, please let me know, or if you have a question, please interject. Otherwise, I'll be talking for about 30, 35 minutes about the Contemporary Art Exhibition Documenta 12. So as I said, today I'll be talking about the exhibition Documenta 12, which took place in Kassel, Germany from June 13th to September 23rd, 2007. For those of you who may be unfamiliar with Documenta, its first installment occurred in the year 1955 and can thus be historically situated within a cultural moment in Germany premised on embracing developments in abstract art which had been negatively targeted under the Third Reich and Hitler's totalitarian regime. Since its inception, Documenta has become central to defining the status of contemporary art, but I would also say that it has affected the writing of modern art history, at least in the United States, which each year extends its global reach, embracing the arts of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Occurring every 5 years instead of 2 years, like the Venice Biennial, or every year in the case of art fairs like Art Basel, Documenta is largely credited with being a serious art exhibition that makes evident particular shifts in art and exhibition practice. As Holland Cotter of the New York Times put it, and I quote, "Documenta sustains its reputation for being an idiosyncratic, concept-driven affair. You go to glamorous, sun-splashed Venice to party, gaze and graze. You come to gray, pleasureless Kassel to think," end quote. And that here I've just showing, I'm just showing you the kind of graphic from Documenta this year on the left, and then a map of Germany so you can situate Kassel in relation to, you know, larger centers such as Cologne and Berlin. This year, the artistic director of the exhibition, Roger Bergel, together with curator Ruth Nowak, proposed three questions that framed discussions surrounding the show prior to its opening. And I've given you on the handout these questions in their kind of expanded form. You know, in the end, I'm just going to be speaking about the last one regarding education. But these three questions in their kind of abbreviated form included, is modernity our antiquity? What is bare life? And what is to be done? In the present context, however, I'll bear down on the third question, what is to be done, as it deals specifically with the question of education, from whence my talk's title, Documenta 12, Exhibiting Education, derives. In 2005, Bergel, the director of Documenta, posed and publicly framed the question about what is to be done as follows, and you can read as I will cite him now. Artists educate themselves by working through form and subject matter. Audiences educate themselves by experiencing things aesthetically. How to mediate the particular content or shape of those things without sacrificing their particularity is one of the great challenges of an exhibition like the Documenta. But there is more to it than that. The global complex of cultural translation that seems to be somehow embedded in art and its mediation sets the stage for a potentially all-inclusive public debate. Bildung, the German term for education, also means generation or constitution, as when one speaks of generating or constituting a public sphere. Today, education seems to offer one viable alternative to the devil, and then in parentheses, didacticism, academia, and the deep blue sea, commodity fetishism, also in parentheses. Here, Bergel describes education as contributing to a public sphere of dialogue and cultural translation. What is more, it seems that education is framed in rather utopian terms as the antidote to didacticism as well as to commodification. Education then becomes the means by which to resist these forces in the present. So in order to delve into the status of education at Documenta, I'd like to focus on education's appearance as subject and object, process and strategy. Within these terms, I'll emphasize three aspects. First, I'll address education as part of Documenta 12's conceptual framework, which I've already begun to unpack in some measure by addressing the question, what is to be done? Then I'll consider education as instantiated in the exhibition installation and in the subject matter of the work on display. Lastly, I'll situate education as part of the dialogue engendered by Documenta 12 and its public programs. So three aspects, education as conceptual framework, education as installation strategy, and also education as engendered through the dialogue in the wake of Documenta's public programs. So part one. As part of Bergel's desire to have a broader public engage the Documenta questions, he proposed a magazine project, a collaboration among magazines in more than 50 countries. organized by Georg Scholhammer, editor of the Austrian magazine Springerin, about 90 magazines were invited to respond to Documenta 12's three questions. The magazines were not leading trade magazines, but rather those with smaller budgets, circulation figures, and that often address local geopolitical and aesthetic concerns. These included, among others, and you see the covers here, of Ramona from Buenos Aires, Multitudes from Paris, also including Zéar from the Basque Country in Spain, Duchu from Beijing, as well as more well-known North American publications, including Grey Room and Cabinet, of course well-known with the kind of proviso that they're more well-known to a Western audience. The magazine's responses to the questions were often framed within regional and local concerns, and thus answered with an eye to the publics to which these respective magazines speak. Moreover, they were also exhibited. An issue of each contributing title was displayed in the Documenta Hala. So I'm just showing you the exterior facade of one of the exhibition venues at Documenta 12, and then how the magazines were actually, the over 90 magazines that were invited to respond to Documenta's themes and questions, how they were displayed there to be regarded by the passersby. The result of this collaborative effort gave intellectual credibility and global relevance to the exhibition and its directors, at the same time that it introduced the various magazines to Documenta's around 700 visitors. Moreover, the articles written for the project formed part of an online section of the Documenta website. Thus linked through the internet on an online archive, some of the articles, however, were also appropriated for the production of three publications, the so-called Documenta magazines. So each magazine responded to the three different questions in various ways, and then articles from those contributions were then kind of selected and published in these three magazines. As Claire Bishop makes clear in her review of the show, the use of the local magazine contributions in these publications invites the question of whether a project, and I quote, intended to give voice to local positions was ultimately instrumentalized as a research and development arm of the exhibition, end quote. So Bishop is very much just pointing to the fact that in many ways the contributions by the local magazines are then being appropriated and used to kind of towards commercial ends on the part of Documenta. And she ultimately states that the Documenta magazines were also published by Taschen, and given that Taschen's recent publications also include the Big Book of Brass, we might ask ourselves how far Documenta is from the deep blue sea of commodity fetishism. After all, this casts in a different light Bergel's question, what is to be done? Given that education was at a high premium in terms of Bergel's conception of the exhibition, it comes as little surprise that perhaps his own silence regarding the list of artists prior to the opening may have been a self-conscious strategy on his part for keeping the media at bay. And this is quite common practice amongst the various Documenta curators. They will repeatedly kind of withhold what artists are going to be participating until the very, you know, last moment, so that too much media attention is not kind of drawn up prior to the actual show. And at a pre-opening press conference, he explained to attending journalists, and I'm quoting Bergel, "You are in the business of packaging things, of making them, so to speak, ready to eat. We, art curators, are in the business of unwrapping them," end quote. So I'm moving on to part two of my talk now. But how exactly was such an unwrapping effected in the exhibition display? Bergel repeatedly made clear, and I quote, "Art communicates itself on its own terms. This is an aesthetic experience in the true sense," end quote. So thus, talking about how education informed the exhibition's installation, one sees how an exhibition of education was instantiated in part by the presentation of the magazines in the Documenta Hala. But in addition to this, I'll look at four recurring practices in the show, what I'll very straightforwardly call infiltration, connect the dots, migration of form, education as subject and structure. So I'll begin with number one. As a large-scale exhibition with over 500 works, actually I'm going to go back for a second. A large-scale exhibition with over 500 works by more than 125 artists, the roster is actually rather modest in size, but the Documenta artists' geographic range stretches from the Canadian Arctic to Southeast Asia. Documenta 12 was also broadly historical in scope, including 16th century Persian calligraphy, 17th century Mughal miniatures, and Indian company paintings from the 19th century. As an exhibition, Documenta takes place in different venues, and I'll show you on this map, or these two maps, This year it took place in the Schloss Wilhelmshöhe, which was actually sited at a remove. It's not actually in downtown Kassel. It's rather probably 3 or 4 kilometers away and up on a hill. And then in downtown Kassel, you have the Museum Friedrichianum, which is Documenta's primary venue, the Documenta Halle, which I've already shown you the image of the facade, the Aue Pavilion, which is actually a provisional structure that was built just for the purposes of Documenta 12, and then also they used the Neue Galerie. And then there's also the Kulturzentrum Schlachthof, which is actually to the north of this map and actually not pictured on the map. So, infiltration. Based on my own experience of the show, the first exhibition strategy I noticed in terms of the exhibition design was that of infiltration. Sited at a remove from downtown Kassel and the main cluster of exhibition venues, the Wilhelmshöhe Kassel houses, among other things, an antiquities collection, old master painting, and a graphic arts collection. In this context, the strategy of infiltrating collections of old work with examples of the new was quite evident in the decision to hang the Polish artist Sofia Kolik's The Splendor of Myself from 1997 in between a self-portrait by Rembrandt from 1664 on the left and the bust of a man with gold chain, also by Rembrandt from the same year on the right. So here's, you know, Kolik's piece in the middle, self-portrait by Rembrandt here, which is obstructed, unfortunately, by this gentleman, and then the bust of a man with a gold chain flanking the piece by Kolik on the other side. Such an infiltration raises the question of self-portraiture and its means of making both then and now. From the painterly execution of Rembrandt to the 9 photo collage elements in Kulik, from the impastoed surface of Rembrandt's paint application to the slick finish of Kulik's digital work. Elsewhere, we find Charlotte Pozenenska's adhesive colored strips on paper in her Streifenbild from 1965, which you see here on the left. Installed across the corner from Lovis Corinth's Valkensee, A Landscape with Cow, from 1921. The juxtaposition, I assume, was meant to elicit a reflection on color, from Corinth's impressionistic use of color in his landscape to color's minimalist and geometric application in Pozenenska. In addition to infiltration, Bergel opted for a connect-the-dots strategy, whereby a work by a single artist was distributed over Documenta's various exhibition venues. This was perhaps nowhere more visible than in the work of Kerry James Marshall, an artist known for his large-scale paintings and objects that take African-American life and history as their subject matter. So here you see 4 of Marshall's paintings, 1, 2, 3, 4, of disaffected black youth from his Lost Boys painting series of 1993, which were installed directly under Carol von Lunder III's Hydaspes and Persina before the painting of Andromeda on the left, and the struggle between 2 pirates, Polaris stabbing his rival Trachonos to death, on the right, both from 1640. On the left, the 2 young black men who stare out at the viewer are just underneath a rather unsavory picture of 2 Ethiopian regents looking rather salaciously at a painting within a painting of a naked Andromeda. Yet it's a bit unclear, and when I first saw this juxtaposition, what message are we to derive from this juxtaposition? They seem to be rather almost arbitrarily hung between these 2 paintings without any real significant motivation except perhaps the skin color of the Ethiopian regents. So with that, on to the next dot. Marshall's work also appears in Documenta's primary venue, the Museum Friedrichianum, and I'm just showing you, again, an external image of the facade. The Friedrichianum Museum is regarded as the first public museum in Europe. It was damaged during World War II, but rebuilt in part for the inaugural Documenta in 1955. Here on the ground floor, one sees Marshall's Could This Be Love from 1992. And what's interesting also in terms of the curators and their desire to kind of paint the interior of the Museum Friedrichianum gallery spaces, all of these very kind of, this is like a kind of salmon pink, and other walls had a kind of blue, deep blue green or kind of beige. And so in the critical literature surrounding the show, many critics were talking about, and also these kind of long curtains which are placed over all of the windows, is how it very much kind of created the effect of almost a bourgeois interior based both on the color scheme and this kind of abundance of curtains hanging throughout the exhibition. Next, one could also find Marshall's work in the Aue Pavilion. I'm just showing you, again, an external image of the structure It was built and designed by Anne Lacaton and Jean-Philippe Fazal on the grounds just in front of the Orangerie, which you see here in the back. And the structure was actually quite large. It was about 9,500 meters squared, built specifically for Documenta 12. And then inside, you could see an example of Marshall's work again, in this case, his Dark Angel from 1989. Finally, Marshall's work was also exhibited at the entrance to the Neue Galerie, showing you again, just so you get a sense of the various venues, an image from the external facade of the Neue Galerie. It was built in the late 19th century as a museum for a collection of old works, and as with the Friedrichsianum, it too was damaged during World War II and opened in 1976 to display painting and sculpture from 1750 to the present. Displayed in alcoves lining the hallway of the Neue Galerie were 40 panels from Marshall's Daily Rhythm Master series from 2007. These are actually inkjet prints on newsprint. Marshall's Rhythm Master is a superhero comic book based on African mythology and art and set in an urban environment. Given the iconographic and narrative quality of Marshall's work, the connect the dots on the part of the viewer was a rather easy visual exercise, at the same time that the strategy foregrounded the diversity of Marshall's work, both in scale and across divergent media. With the work of other artists, however, such as Mira Shundel, her work's recurrence in this kind of what I'm calling connect the dots strategy was less evident, more visually quiet, one might say. A Swiss Jewish immigrant to Sao Paulo at the moment of concrete art's triumph, Shundel's graphic work on paper, which displays her interest in the materiality of language and signs, was featured at the Wilhelmshohe Castle alongside other works on paper presented in glass display cases. And so here you have an image from her notebook from 1968. In another image, this one was actually displayed in one of the display cases from 1971. Her monotypia, or monotypes, were also shown in the pavilion. In the monotypia, Shundel uses rice paper as a semi-transparent support to register action and gesture in a fashion that is counter to her roughly contemporaneous work with hard-edged geometric lines that we saw in the previous image. In the Friedrichsianum, Shundel's Droginia, or Little Nothing, was also prominently on display. The Droginia elaborates bodily gesture as a material accretion in and of real space. I'm talking about this work that's hanging here and also a part of it that's also in the display case on the bottom. The Droginias are also made of rice paper, but in this case, its transparency has been made thick, as it is kneaded into rope that has been subsequently woven into multiple knots. It is through their material thickness and tactile appeal that these works literalize a fascination with the materiality of textured form. Indeed, it is with works such as Shundel's that viewers were asked to be most attentive, as the consistency or readability of an artist's style was not so visible as part of the connect the dots strategy. Or, as Nancy Princenthal explains in her review, and I quote, "Standards for attention are, throughout Documenta 12, perilously high," end quote. This is to say that given the scant information on each artist, the viewer is called upon to look actively both within and across the various exhibition venues. The curators self-consciously disavow a kind of model of a curator as, you know, explicator of the work on view in order to, in a sense, I would say, force viewers to experience the work based on what they see. And actually, if you're interested in Mira Shundel's work in particular, there's quite a few examples of her work now in the Latin American New Acquisitions show here at MoMA. That you can visit both on the second and third floor. So I really encourage you to go see it, not only for Shundel's work, but also for the kind of rigor and, well, for me, that's been one of my favorite shows at MoMA. In any case, I really highly recommend that you go see it. So the third strategy I want to focus on, and which was by far the most commented strategy in terms of the press, is migration of form. I mention it third, but it was in large part the guiding curatorial principle of Documenta 12. Migration of form is a concept that for Burgle stresses formal resemblances across space and time. He explains, and I quote, "Art from Africa has to look African, art from the Arab world, Arabic. But what is African and what is Arabic? The exhibition is above all precisely that, an exhibition, and not a means of packaging knowledge that informs us about local contexts. For if we take that path, we reduce art to illustration," end quote. The work in Documenta is thereby contextualized according to formal analogies rather than culture or geography. As a result, Daniel Birnbaum explains in his review that textile, weaving, and strings reappear as the literal stuff of art while also serving as a curatorial metaphor that recurs throughout the exhibition. So as an instantiation of what Birnbaum wittingly calls string theory, one sees here Indian artist Sheila Goda's And, an installation built of cords, needles, thread, and red pigment. The work in part explores the power of red pigment in Hinduism, but here it is largely appreciated on formal grounds. It appears as a voluminous composition of lines, curving and defining the space. A kind of string appears again in the work we previously saw by Mira Shendel, her Little Nothings. And indeed, weaving knots, threads continue to emerge in work after work, as in Hu Xiaoyuan's needlework on silk using the artist's own black hair. So this is the actual installation, and this is a detail of one of his works. And this work is titled A Keepsake I Cannot Give Away from 2005. Trisha Brown's installation for her performance, Floor of the Forest, which you see on the left from 1970, uses a mesh of ropes inside a metal scaffolding as the prop for three dancers who perform while suspended in the structure. So it's a bit difficult to see. I mean, you see the structure better in this instance on the right with the dancers performing Accumulation, which is actually a different dance piece. And here you can see them, the three dancers in this structure. And what was interesting about, for me, this kind of presence of dancers in Documenta is the extent to which, I mean, at least in the United States and my own knowledge of in this country, there was much overlap and crossover between, you know, minimalist dance and visual aesthetic practice in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so to have these props there, but were not just displayed as props, but were actually then activated through dancers actually appearing at various intervals to perform the work for the audiences that happened to be present at that time. Textiles also literally appear in the form of a carpet from northwest Iran from approximately 1800, hung on a wall behind Cosima von Bonin's large-scale installation, Relax, It's Only a Ghost. In von Bonin's work, massive soft toy puppies are on display together with her minimalist viewing platforms. So you can see in the detail her puppies and then these viewing platforms that recall Solowit. While the carpet, which we see here, is angled in such a way that it makes it seem like it's ready to fly and conjures the land that gives us flying carpets, a crossroads for cultural commerce, at the same time that weaving again stands in here as a metaphor for this exchange. So given the significant presence of Muslims in Kassel and in all of Germany, the presence of this Iranian carpet, exhibited together with the work of a contemporary Cologne-based artist, redirects the question of weaving of forms across space and time toward altogether different issues regarding the present. In his review, Tom Hollert speaks to the semantic operation of the term migration in German, Migration, which is much closer in meaning to immigration in English. To thus speak of the migration of form in tandem with an exhibition that promotes aesthetic integration is for Hollert to, and I quote, suggest an analogy between the integration of immigrants and the integration of forms. Hence, the pedagogy of the nation state and the pedagogy of aesthetic education become one and the same, end quote. Yet Bergel, the artistic director of Documenta, his optimism and hope for the installation was to emphasize an appreciation of form without the attending tags of cultural identity that often limit a work's meaning. Nevertheless, the contradiction that ensues is a productive one. On the one hand, there's the desire to have the viewer be attentive to formal resonances as a way of providing a model of a non-hierarchical art history and exhibition display. But at the same time, what results is an exhibition that puts many of its works together based on morphology, and that consequently stresses sameness rather than difference. So lastly, in addition to infiltration, connect the dots, and the migration of form, there were works that actually took up education as subject matter, using classrooms, dialogue, chalkboards, desks, and chairs as part of the material means by which to make a work. This was most true of the work Nine Scripts for a Nation at War, a collaboration among Andrea Geyer, Sharon Hayes, Ashley Hunt, Katya Zunder, David Thorne, who have been working together as artists, organizers, researchers, and writers on and off for the last 7 years. Nine Scripts from a Nation at War is the title of their collaborative project, a 10-channel video installation. The work is structured around the question, and I quote, "How does war construct specific positions for individuals to fill, enact, speak from, or resist?" End quote. Their work considers how we are positioned as certain kinds of individuals in relation to war. Veteran, student, citizen, actor, blogger, lawyer, journalist, interviewer. It probes questions such as who authorizes whom to speak, whose voices are being heard, what is the meaning of repetition within the learning process, how is knowledge generated? And as you see here, these were actually these viewing stations. The work is actually comprised of these kind of individual viewing stations that are connected to headsets so that each individual could have a real, I guess, isolated engagement with the work. And they're also featured in the Documenta Hala. So they're actually literally in the space behind where the magazines were displayed, which is a space that doesn't require any kind of admission. And it's also where all of Documenta's public programs took place, which I'll show you in a moment. And so it was very much a work that was kind of accessible to everyone in the public at any moment and any time that the exhibition was open. So, for instance, in one script, selections from interviews with soldiers having returned from the Iraq War are heard in tandem with the starts and stops of the utterances transcription. And you can read on the right slide as I quote, "One thing is that I don't fear anything. I don't fear for my life or anything like that. I don't know. I just live every day like it's going to be the last. And actually, I see a therapist at the VA hospital. And she asked me a question like a week ago. She asked me, do I feel like I'm going to die soon? And I said, yes. But the reason why, she said, is because people who experience tragedy, they usually feel like this is going to be the end. So I just live every day like it's going to be the last. In." And I think for me, when viewing this work, what was so, I guess, convincing about its actual kind of formal articulation was that at the same time that we're hearing the, you know, veteran speak about his experience in the war, we're made acutely aware of those impasses in his speech because of the starts and stops of the transcribing that's happening, you know, and kind of scrolling along the screen at the same time that we're listening, and that somehow that kind of increased materiality that is given to those pauses created a kind of increased effective response, at least in terms of my own viewing of that particular work. Or more pertinent to the question of education, in another script, a group of anthropology students at the New School for Social Research in New York interview one another on various questions, including ethnographic narrative and the impact of war on the classroom. In this video, the students rotate positions, acting as both interviewer and interviewee. "How does the war change the classroom?" one student asks. The other answers, "It puts more pressure on the things we're talking about." While another, by contrast, responds, "Not enough." And this is actually a photograph I took standing in front of those viewing stations. So in this case, the work is actually split into two different screens. And what happens is you see one of the students come in and take the position of the interviewee, and then that's the interviewer, and then she'll depart, and then this same individual will switch places and then subsequently play the other role. And so you have this constant rotation kind of going in and out of the door as the subjects are also kind of changing their physical position and agency in relation to the various questions that they're proposing among one another. The collaboration between the artists and these students points to their mutual interest in radical pedagogy, not only for the people playing out these scripts, but also for ourselves as viewers. For not only are these scripts meant to be read, they're also meant to be heard. And in so doing, they reveal the extent to which our own positions as viewers are scripted. By showing people who rehearse their own scripts, we might be prompted then to reimagine our own. Other works took up education as subject and structure and functioned more like education stage sets, as in Gerald Rockenschaub's classroom setting. And here we can see a tour group that's actually kind of sitting in the work. And at this point, the blackboard actually has no kind of writing or graffiti on it. And on another occasion, two women who have gone up to the blackboard to write something on it. And then here, just a detail of the blackboard at the end of the day after multiple interventions by documented 12 visitors. So the last work I'd like to discuss before moving on to public programs is the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei's Fairy Tale. In this work, the artist distributed 1,001 wooden chairs from the Qing Dynasty in all of the exhibition sites. They were set up in rows or groups as resting places, but also as spaces for dialogue among members of the public. And on the right, we can see here how a school group has kind of taken advantage of the space designated for the chairs in order to wrap up whatever discussion they were having. So in addition to education as conceptual framework, exhibition installation strategy, education was also, of course, instantiated through Documenta's various public programs. Included in Documenta 12 was a space in Documenta Hala that functioned as a general space for public gatherings with no admission fee. It is here that all of Documenta's lunchtime lectures and workshops took place. The education programs included other traditional formats, such as tours for adults and children, as well as tours by local students, or tours given by local students in Castle. In addition, there were education projects based on the transfer of knowledge and networking. These projects were primarily geared toward educational institutions, voluntary associations, and self-help groups, which had a specific interest in reflecting on art education. What is more, in order to extend its educational reach, all the tours as well as the lunchtime lectures are available for download on the Documenta website. So if you're interested in listening to any of the lectures, the Documenta website, I didn't actually put the address on the handout I gave you, but it's www.documenta12.de for Deutschland. So I'd like to conclude more specifically with the response to Documenta 12 on the part of the Paris-based journal Multitudes. As with other magazines, Multitudes was asked by the Documenta 12 organizers to answer to the exhibition's three questions, and they also participated in a workshop at Documenta within the first 2 weeks of the exhibition's opening. The journal responded by creating an online counter-project called Critical and Clinical Documentation. Here, the three questions were reformulated and addressed to artists. And so the original Documenta questions on the top and the counter question by Multitudes is on the bottom. Is modernity your aftermath? Is bare life your apocalyptic political dimension? And what is to be done after the Documenta 12 Bildung program? Artists were asked to situate their work in relation to Documenta 12's themes, but also in relation to their participation or non-participation in the exhibition. The ensemble of responses offer alternative, multiple, and ironic points of view regarding the exhibition's themes and Documenta itself. Conceived by Eric Allies and Giovanna Saperi, I'd like to focus on Multitudes' counter question concerning education. And so you could read along with me. Will your participation, non-participation in Documenta 12 help you not to feel lost between the devil, didacticism, academia, and the deep blue sea, commodity fetishism? Did reading Schiller make you feel romantic? Have you walked through Habermas's public sphere? Are you sharing Rancière's distribution of the sensible? Would you still prefer to fly with Deleuze and Guattari? Develop as you wish, with or without reading list. The question, at times funny and parodic and at times ridiculous with its seemingly flippant evocation of French and German philosophers, was sent to more than 250 artists. Multitudes' counter questions and the artists' responses points to and expands upon Bergel's idea of what he called the exhibition as medium. For beyond exhibiting the specificity of any one art, be it painting, sculpture, etc., Documenta 12 and the organizer's conception of an exhibition as a medium instantiates what medium literally means. That is, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, a medium is a means or channel of communication or expression, end quote. Documenta 12 served to spark dialogue and debate, not only about contemporary art, but also the means by which it gets exhibited and discussed, packaged and put on display, art's potential to educate the public, but also the limits of art education. In this way, it asked us to consider what relevance art has today. So in conclusion, I'd actually like to end with one of the, and I really encourage you to go and look at the different responses by various artists on the Documenta, or the counter website produced by Multitudes. But I want to show you one artist's response. If I can get it up, okay. It's a video, so I'll be there in a second. Okay. Thank you. So this short video produced by Marco Rosso for as part of Multitude's counter question website is at once funny and alarming, but it suggests that there's still much to be done with the traditional means of education, both inside and outside of the purview of the contemporary art exhibition. Thank you. We still have about 5 minutes if anyone has any question or would like to kind of peruse collectively the Multitude's website for other answers. In terms of the website, I find what's most telling is actually the people who refuse to respond to Multitude's because they didn't quite understand the irony in their kind of questions. So I don't know, I could go to that. Right, yeah.
One question regarding the I remember when I got this email 3 years ago about the questions, the main questions of the documenta and the kind of invitation to contribute to the journal. And I was very much appalled by the fact that all of the three major questions, like is modernity our antiquity, what is bad life, and what is to be done, they pretend to be not to be engendered by contemporary and not so contemporary philosophy. That is, they are not giving you names.
Right.
Like the 12 curators, documented 12 curators, trying to be very anti-theoretical on
right.
the surface.
Right.
Because the previous document by Huy and Zoran Sarath Maharaj and the rest was very heavy on theoretical kind of overload.
Right.
And they, of course, were not ready to let theory go as it is. But what they chose to do is, you know, to ask what is bad life without referring to George Wagonga.
Right, exactly.
So there is this kind of totally hypocritical, pseudo-theoretical thing, and I just want to know what your personal opinion, because I remember that I was so angry when I got this question at the beginning, because I felt that there is this kind of semi, or kind of, you know, we are theoretical, we are exclusive, we are elitist, but we don't even have the guts to kind of make this theoretical information transparent. That was my
yeah, I mean, the question, what is bare life, I mean, to me is the most, I mean, one, they don't even give Agamben credit. I mean, they just kind of like throw it out as if it was just something that they kind of like fashioned and floating in the air. Also, in one of the reviews, what's interesting is, of course, you know, Agamben wrote these books in the mid-90s, and so people who are really invested in kind of radical philosophy, like, you know, Agamben is like, a decade ago, and meanwhile it's just being introduced now into kind of art, contemporary art criticism and discourse, so there's this kind of disconnect also both in terms of the kind of specificity of the historical production of Agamben and his writing and how that then is, you know, 10 years later kind of being picked up, and Agamben's everywhere in contemporary art criticism, I mean, as you're well aware. I'm sorry? It's a deep blue sea. Yeah, exactly. It is a deep blue sea. Yeah, most definitely. On the one hand, I mean, just to get more specifically to your question, I mean, I do, on some level, I mean, there is this kind of underlying elitist position, I think, with the documenta curators as well. And I want to kind of take them at their word when they really want viewers to be exercising their kind of visual intelligence in a way. But at the same time, I do think that viewers are sometimes left a little too adrift without any kind of, I don't know, you know, this kind of abdication of responsibility on the part of the curators, which is what you're suggesting. Yeah. So this is actually, just so you can see, what would you, if you go to the first page of the Multitudes website, this is what you would arrive at. And so the artist's responses are included in these files, so it's set up like a file cabinet. And each one, the first one is modernity, our aftermath, and then is bare life, your apocalyptic political dimension, and then what is to be done are distributed according to the three file cabinets. And then you have people, the people who refuse to answer over here in the trash. So they're still present, even through the act of refusal. And those are quite telling, actually. I mean, if you go in and look at them. So, any other questions?
You can look into the trash.
Yeah, we can look into the trash. I just have a very difficult time with this funny mouse here, but yes. So, I'm not sure who, let's see if I can figure out who responded to this. So Carlos Mota, is that who that's from? Yeah, and so you can go through and then see what... So what did he write? Please accept my apologies for my late reply to your invitation to contribute to Multitudes in the context of D12 magazines. I can justify my delay as part of the process of thinking about your invitation and by extension about my contribution to this forum. I must confess that I've had a troublesome time thinking about how my work would fit within the conceptual framework of your critical initiative in response to whatever. So, and then there's other ones that actually kind of outright reject Multitudes and their proposition, calling it kind of infantile and ridiculous, and you know, that somehow the kind of irony of, you know, it's a critical irony. I think they're very much kind of in play and trying to kind of instantiate some type of a dialogue was somehow kind of missed. I don't know if it was somehow translation French context to kind of North American context. All right, well, if there are no more questions, thanks so much for coming. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Thanks.